thank you very much for inviting me. And I'd like to say I'm really glad that the subject of this inaugural event for the new cluster of Wolfson is Europe. There are important links between Wolfson and Europe. Both Isaac Wolfson, the main benefactor, and Isaiah Berlin, the first president of the college, were products of the European Jewish diaspora, which has so enriched British society and British culture. Wolfson's father was a cabinet maker from Poland who settled in the Gorbals in Glasgow. Berlin's father was a timber merchant in Latvia, and I paid my respects to Isaiah Berlin outside the house in Riga where he was a boy. Anyway, these two founding fathers of Wolfson illustrate how much this college and this country owes to the fact that it's inextricably involved with Europe. My contribution to this discussion is as a practitioner, or rather an ex-practitioner, who's worked both for British ministers in Whitehall and for the European Commission in Brussels. I'm not a politician, but I have been a policy maker at the interface between power and administration. In a sense, I confess to being a Eurosceptic, in the sense that everyone involved in government should continually question government and systems of government. One should be skeptical about important matters of this kind. But I'm not a Eurosceptic in the sense of being systematically opposed to the European Union. On the contrary, I believe that the European Union is the best framework we have for organizing relations between the states of Europe in a way that optimizes our chances of domestic peace and prosperity and helps our countries to project European interests more effectively on the world stage. Now, I'm not a lawyer, and I'm not an economist, so I'm going to leave those two topics to the two distinguished speakers who follow me. What I can talk about is how the European Union works. But on the economic aspects, I just want to say this. The EU is going through a very difficult period, mainly because of the economic and financial crisis, from which not only the Europeans, but the whole world is still struggling to recover. Also because of the poor management of the rules for the euro. While one can justifiably criticize the conduct of the EU's member states, including the United Kingdom, and of the EU itself, first in allowing the crisis to develop and then in dealing with it, I have absolutely no doubt that without the EU framework, we would be in worse difficulties today. Now, speaking as an insider with some experience of the workings of the European Union, I am sure that its institutions can cope with the stresses and strains that are now being experienced. The EU will emerge stronger from this crisis as it has from past crises. The members of the Eurozone are determined to remedy some of its design faults. Many of them want to go, as Anne said, for deeper integration, although they haven't quite figured out how to do it, but they want to do it. And all the member states want to safeguard Europe's single market of 500 million people. In fact, the crisis is spurring efforts to improve the single market. For example, in the field of financial services, where we need better regulation. Yes, I said we need better regulation on a Europe-wide basis, including the City of London. Wasn't it bad regulation of the financial sector that got us into this mess in the first place? Now, since I don't have time to discuss the EU's institutional framework in a comprehensive way, I'm going to focus my remarks on the European Commission. I worked for it, so I can't claim to be fully objective, but I think I managed to maintain my critical faculties. And believe me, if you work for an organization for as long as 33 years, you know what's wrong with it. And since it no longer employs me, I can say what I think. Let me just share with you my views on the role of the European Commission. First, it's the guardian of the treaties. It's the referee who from time to time can blow the whistle when member states break the rules. And this is very, very important function because the European Union is a law-based system. In Brussels, there's no army, there's no police force to enforce the rules. It's a law-based system and therefore it's important to have a referee. Second role, the European Commission is the initiator, the proponent of new policies or the improvement of existing policies. Common policies on which it has to make proposals in the European interest. It's not a decision-making body, the European Commission. It doesn't take important decisions, except in the field of competition policy. The decisions are taken by the Council and the Parliament. So its second important role is as the motor of integration in making proposals. Third task is managing programmes under the common policies. And fourth task, which is sometimes overlooked and perhaps not officially mentioned, is that it's the protector of the interests of the smaller member states. If there were only three or four big states in Europe, I'm not sure we would need the European Union, but both the wars that we had in the last century were sparked by the power game of the big countries in respect of the smaller countries. And that's why the Commission has an important task to reassure the smaller, weaker states that they will not be rolled over by the big ones. I want to emphasize that the Commission's role is completely different from the two other institutions. It's the Council of Ministers, which is the main decision-making body, that represents the states. It's the European Parliament that represents the people. That's where the democracy is supposed to be. For me, the Commission has a quite different role. It's not there to represent states. It's not there even to represent the people. It's there to develop the European interest. It's not a power-hungry group of crazy bureaucrats who are looking for more power. It doesn't need more power. It shouldn't have it. It should function more effectively. And I'm going to say that I think that in the first two of the roles I've described, the Commission has been less effective in recent years than it should have been. And let me give you two examples. First of all, its role as guardian of the treaties, as whistleblower. I think that when errors were made in the management of the Eurozone, that's the acceptance of false economic accounts presented by Greece, and the transgression of the rules by Germany and France, whose budget deficits exceeded 3%, then the Commission should have been more outspoken and acted more vigorously in its role as guardian of the law. In the second field I mentioned, the initiator of new policies, I think the European Commission should be more proactive in the European interest. It shouldn't act as the secretariat, just taking instructions from the member states. It should be out there somewhere in front, trying to lead on to better things. But in this role, it's a fact that the Commission has suffered from the wish of the bigger member states to impose the intergovernmental model, which means basically keeping the Parliament and the Commission out of it. And that's been the case not only in the field of the euro, but also more recently in foreign policy. It's interesting that the economic and financial crisis has actually restored the Commission's authority in some ways. For example, Olli Rehn, the Commissioner for Economic Affairs, has been given important new tasks. And by the way, he'll be speaking here in Oxford on the 17th of May at St. Anthony's. Even the British government accepts that the Commission has an important role to play in resolving the present crisis. And paradoxically, the more the United Kingdom adopts an offshore, semi-detached position in the European Union, the more the British depend on the Commission to defend their interests in the inner councils. The Commission has systematically tried to ensure that the 17 members of the Eurozone don't ignore the interests of the 10 non-members, including Britain. So I want to conclude the first part of my talk by saying that my answer to the question posed in the title of this conference, is Europe on the brink, is certainly no. It will survive. It will do better. Frankly, I'm more concerned these days with the question, is the United Kingdom on the brink of Europe, to which my answer is possibly yes. And I'm going to develop that point in what remains of my talk. It's a fundamentally important point for those of us who live in Oxford and vote in this country. There's always been a tendency on the part of the British to see the European Union as an economic enterprise, a common market and little more. But the leaders who took Britain into the European Union, they didn't think that. Let me quote what Prime Minister Harold Macmillan said to the Parliament in 1961 when his government announced its application for membership. He said that membership is a political as well as an economic issue. And later in 1971, the then Foreign Secretary, Sir Alec Douglas Hume, later Prime Minister, he said in the House of Commons, quote, "On two counts, I am in full agreement with the most vocal opponents of our entry into Europe. The first is that our application is a step of the utmost political significance. And the second is that there is a danger of its political importance being overlooked in the public debate on the economic issues." And Douglas Hume went on to say, and this is interesting from the point of view of a respected conservative politician, "It seems to me that the only way to preserve our independence for the future is to join a larger grouping. It may seem paradoxical, but I believe it to be true." Unquote. Now, these quotations show that from the beginning, the approach of British politicians to the European Union was never ideological, it was pragmatic. Britain's reasons for joining had nothing to do with sentiment and everything to do with realpolitik. And they can be summed up with the maxim, if you can't beat them, join them. And that maxim is still valid today. Despite the complications and frustrations of membership of the European Union, there is no good alternative for this country. Now, some commentators argue that the Eurozone will disintegrate, that the European Union is in decline, and that Britain should move its focus of attention away from the continental neighbours to wider horizons. Sometimes this analysis is tinged with schadenfreude. We British enjoy seeing the euro in difficulty. We had the good sense not to join it. Let's hope it will collapse, and then we will really be vindicated. And it's even reminiscent of British attitudes to the Messina Conference in 1955, when they said, "We don't think the common market will work, so let's join in with the six in creating, let's not join with the six in creating it." And now that proved in the 50s to be wishful thinking and an error of judgment on the big scale. A similar risk exists today for those who predict failure in the European process. Now, I didn't say there is no alternative to EU membership for Britain. There certainly are alternatives. A European state outside the European Union can function very well. And the classic examples are Norway, and I'm pleased we have a number of Norwegian friends here today, and Switzerland, which you mentioned, Anne. Norway, together with Iceland and Liechtenstein, is in the European Economic Area, which gives access to the single market and several other common policies, but exemption from most of the EU's agricultural policy and fisheries policy. In a sense, that's quite attractive from the British point of view, and the EEA is the closest form of relationship that the EU ever made with its neighbours, short of full membership. But it has a price. Norway pays an annual fee of £165 million into the budget, and more important, the EEA means simply that many laws decided by the EU are directly applicable in Norway. A recent report to the Norwegian government stated, and I quote, "The most problematic aspect of Norway's form of association with the European Union is the fact that Norway is in practice bound to adopt EU policies and rules on a broad range of issues without being a member and without voting rights. This raises democratic problems. Norway isn't represented in decision-making processes that have direct consequences for Norway, nor do we have significant influence on them," unquote. Now, if Britain left the European Union, it would need to develop a relationship with the European Union, and it's often believed that the default mode would be the EEA. So it's very important to understand what that means and to consider whether it would be appropriate for Britain. Now, in my opinion, and I must be careful here with my Norwegian friends, what may be acceptable for Norway, a small, oil-rich country of 5 million people, would be much less acceptable for Britain, a bigger country with a different history and a different concept of its international role. But of course, it's not the policy of the British government to leave the European Union. What it did, this government, soon after taking office, was to enact a European Union Act with a so-called referendum lock that subjects to a national referendum any future transfer of power from the UK to Brussels. Now, we could have a long debate here on the use of referendums and their place in the British system. Personally, I'm against them. But the fact is that those Eurosceptics who are opposed to an increase in the powers of the European Union should be largely satisfied with the present state of affairs. But are they? No. Many members of the Conservative Party, together with the UK Independence Party, want to go further. They want to repatriate legislation to Westminster, to disengage Britain from areas of EU policy, and even to leave the EU altogether. And for me, this kind of position can hardly be called Euroscepticism. It's more a sort of Europhobia, which considers that everything coming from Brussels must be bad, and that the EU is acting against British interests. I want to conclude by saying that the veto, the so-called veto that was exercised last December at a summit meeting by the British Prime Minister, is sometimes interpreted as a watershed in Britain's policy on its place in the EU. Even the beginning of a conscious policy to embrace a formal multi-tier structure of membership in which Britain would be in the second or third tier. On the one hand, this veto affair demonstrated that members of the Eurozone and most of the others have a red line in relations with the United Kingdom. It's one thing for the British to act as a reluctant European, to refuse to join in with important projects. But if Britain tries to prevent the others from doing things together, even without Britain, or ask concessions in return for that, they won't accept it. And this analysis suggests that Britain's policy on the European Union is now uncomfortably situated somewhere between a rock and a hard place. Almost by default, we may see the development of a two- or three-tier structure of membership in which Britain would be in the outer circle. This could have serious economic and political consequences for us, without Britain being at the table and having a vote. If you're not at the table, then your point of view is not going to be taken into account. I've heard this expressed more brutally in the following way: if you're not at the table, you will be on the menu. So let me conclude by saying that's why I think Britain is now possibly on the brink of Europe. Unless it acts in a more positive and energetic way within the European Union, it may relegate itself to a secondary role. The EU is an imperfect, difficult, and frustrating system of organizing the European continent, but it's the best system that we have, and it's in Britain's interest to exploit it, to influence it, and make it work better. Thank you.